So welcome back to School Sucks, Bill. It's great to have you back.
Oh, it's always an honor to be on here, Brett. I love your show and I love what you're doing with this because to me, if education and learning aren't honed towards liberty, everything will fail.
Servants and people dressed in grey. Got no privacy, got no liberty, 'cause the 20th century people took it all away from me.
We are continuing today with our series on Stoicism, which is growing. Every time we do an episode, the series grows. Originally, it was going to be two parts, then three, and now I'm happy to announce that we're going to actually do four parts in this series. So I just wanted to do a quick bullet list on what we've covered so far, and that will set the stage for where we're going to go today. In the first episode, if people haven't heard these, we defined the philosophy of Stoicism and differentiated it from small s Stoicism as it's used today. We talked about some of the tenets, some of the basics of Stoicism, tranquility, the freedom from distracting emotions. We talked about the practice of meditation, specifically negative visualization, which was imagining less than optimal to very tragic situations and picturing where we would be and how we would deal with those situations if they occurred. We talked about training through voluntary discomfort. We talked about the sphere of control. We defined internals and externals as far as that control was concerned. And we discussed very briefly some criticisms and concerns. The second part in the series was pretty much devoted to going through the 10 themes of Stoicism. And Billy, I think it would be worthwhile just to rattle these off really quickly.
Sure, let's do that.
Folks, all right.
Yes.
The first one was recognizing what is under your control and what isn't under your control and not worrying about what isn't under your control. Two is conforming your will with the divine order of the universe, or essentially being in concert with nature. Do you think that would be a fair way to describe
Indeed.
It? Okay. Three, understanding your emotions. And this is important. Recognizing also, too, that there is this divide between beliefs and emotions. And some Stoics have said that all emotions are based on irrational beliefs. How do you feel about that statement?
I think that not all emotions are irrational. For instance, I consider love to be a rational emotion in this sense. Love may be that anchor emotion that makes us not only act our best with ourselves, but act our best with others. And if I may tangentially address that this way, I think you and I are pro-life, in that we wish that everything that we do as people and everything we'd like society to do is life-affirming and based on voluntarism, cooperation, and persuasion, that we would like to see the fundaments and the roots of every society and community that you and I are involved in done in a way that doesn't act altruistically, but acts in a way that is self-interested, yet always embraces love and life, because in the end, everybody wins.
Yeah. Then that
so that's
is in
why
our
I think to a certain extent it's rational. Yes,
yeah.
Agreed.
Okay, so the real thrust of the third one is being the master of your own mind.
Yes.
The fourth one, doing the right thing no matter the cost. And I know we're kind of going through these quickly for the folks listening, but these are all explained in great detail in the second installment of this series. Five, understand that events are not problematic. Rather, it's your thinking that makes them so. Adjusting your beliefs and expectations to fit reality is very important. Six, live with compassion and respect for human rights, which we just touched on. Seven, cultivate right thinking through daily activities like meditation, contemplation, reflecting, and journaling. And I will say, Bill, that I finally have made a routine out of meditation now. Every morning as soon as I wake up, and that was triggered by the beginning of this series. I had talked about, you know, doing this. I had done shows about meditation. I've certainly dabbled in meditation in the past, but it is the first 5 to 10 minutes of every weekday now, right when I wake up. And I found it to be helpful. I found it to be
helpful. It helps you get ready for your day and just make that transition from sleep to being productive.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, to just kind of stay in a quiet mind and observe the things that come into that quiet mind, you know, and then kind of move them aside and go back to the quiet mind. And I also think that what I'm describing is kind of a basic introductory form of meditation where you're just basically learning how to settle, you know, and then there are actually meditative practices, including the ones we've discussed related to Stoicism, but there's others as well, visualization practices. But a good foundation for learning to meditate is just learning how to quiet the mind and focus on the breath, and that is a foundation for building more advanced meditation practices from there.
I agree.
The eighth one, understand the external world is determined, but you have inner freedom to choose your attitude towards these determined events. 9, calmness, humility, discipline, and indifference to pleasure and pain. Because of their worldview and training, the Stoics are calm in the face of adversity. And number 10, stop whining. Turn adversity into advantage, which is basically building on the prior 9 themes.
And read Ryan Holiday's new book, The Obstacle is a Way, where he talks about all of these things, and I highly recommend it. I think it's, besides Irvine's book that you shared earlier in the second episode concerning the joy of Stoic living, and Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and Seneca and Zeno and all the rest of them, you can read these folks and take all these nuggets of information and philosophy from them and form them into a cohesive whole. You can make it a lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely. So that's the summary of the first two discussions that we had on Stoicism, and we wanted to move today into what you described, Bill, originally as 8 moral lessons of Stoicism.
8 moral lessons from Stoicism that I've garnered from my reading and the width and breadth of the studies that I've made in Stoicism. I found these, and I thought that they were informative, and they're great touch points for us to sort of not only reiterate the things that we've gone over in the first two episodes, but expand that a bit and tease out some other more subtle arguments that the Stoics make about living this life worth living, about living this life that's well examined, and about living this life that others look to you and they say, I think that he's found maybe a key to happiness.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So where do we begin?
Well, what I would suggest is that these 8 moral lessons are divined from a variety of sources, and I'll send you some stuff if I may that maybe you could put in the show notes and such.
Sure.
The first lesson would be developing an understanding of the meaning of human life as it assails us from the 3 directions that Stoics concentrate on, which is the body, the external world, and our relationships. And of course, the last one would be how our mind and soul, depending on how your audience interprets that relationship in itself, affects the relationships that we not only have with people external to ourselves, but the relationship that we have to ourselves. You know, establishing tranquility isn't only being that guy in the room where all of a sudden something goes awry and there's one guy who's standing there who's calm, who's either issuing direction or he's saying this is what needs to be done, or he's just that calm pillar in the storm to whom people gather around. That's why you'll find that Marcus Aurelius's Meditations were written for the most part in campaign tents while the emperor was on the campaign trail with the Roman army, quashing rebellions around the empire as they expanded.
Right.
Ironically
right.
enough, you know, here you have this rather bloodied military genius, Marcus Aurelius, who is retreating to his campaign tent every evening after the latest, you know, blood-soaked festivities, and writing this stuff down that not only does have a relationship to military endeavors, but has a relationship to to live a peaceful life, ironically enough.
You know, that brings up a really interesting thing. And I wanted to put the development of the philosophy in a historical context. So you mentioned Marcus Aurelius, but let's go back maybe about 500 years when we're sure. in Greece. And it seems like the philosophies of Stoicism and Epicureanism were developing at a time where most people believed that Greece was in decline. And these were two different views as to how to deal with that decline, right? The Stoicism, which we've talked about, and the Epicureans being more like, well, you know, just enjoy life, seek pleasure, more so than the Stoics, but both being responses to this perception of decline. But when we go 500 years forward to this other great Stoic, Marcus Aurelius, he was the last of the what was called the five good emperors in Rome.
Yes. So yeah, it was around 180 AD, something like that. But of course, this can be stipulated.
Sure. So, and he was, I think his reign happened during it did. It was during what was called Pax Romana, this peace of Rome, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. But his individual experience might not have been consistent with that whole broader historical trend, right? You talk about him out on a campaign trail putting down rebellion. So it's interesting, when I was going through the notes I used to use to teach world history, and I was just, unfortunately, I can't control find my own notebooks, but I was flipping through looking for Stoicism. And, you know, I found it in Greeks, right around the time of Alexander the Great. And then I found it in mentioned again under Marcus Aurelius during Pax Romana. And it seemed like to me initially, and I wanted to ask you about this, these were two different periods, one a period of decline and one a period of expansion and prosperity. And I was wondering why Marcus Aurelius, or how, I guess more importantly, he embraced this philosophy, if you know. I mean, there might not be a quick answer.
I'd have to speculate on that. But of course, I think folks who tend to be introverted instead of extroverted are much more attracted to Stoicism. That's my observation. And I also think Marcus Aurelius was a very bright introvert who was a reluctant emperor, because when you read about his life, you discover that he turned his nose up at a lot of what he had to do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Didn't really like it, but took it as his duty, as his honorific, to do what he did. As far as Greece being in decline with Stoicism, that's really interesting, because it was around 350 BC before Zeno at Citium, it sort of founded this school, and then other schools that became Stoic sub-philosophies came from there. And you have this almost 600-year time up until Marcus Aurelius, in which you had various Greeks who did go in decline because of one important fact, and that's the Romans took over the Greeks for a large period of time politically. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was folded into the Roman Empire. But of course, we see like what happens later with the Roman Empire, where initially they try to crush Christianity, but eventually over time, not only does it supersede all the Roman emperors, but it bifurcates the empire into the Western and the Eastern Empire and everything that we've seen since in history. I think I haven't considered that, though. Brett, I think that's really interesting as to whether this was a response to Greek decline or whether this was simply the implication of a practical philosophy. Because, you know, philosophies are us throughout humanity, whether East or West. There's always been this plurality of philosophical disciplines. You know, we have Stoic virtues, which tend to be Epictetan, but then we have the Epicureans, who tend to be hedonistic. And I don't think they dismiss the Stoics, but they go down a completely different philosophical track on what is a life worth living.
Yeah.
Of course, that's what all philosophies do, is they say, how can we either make our life worth living, or how can we improve it, and how can we convince other people to follow what we do? That seems to be a stream in philosophy. Although I would tell you, when it comes to Stoic philosophy, I think because of the inherent introversion, reflection, contemplation, and really lack of concern for what happens outside your own self that you're developing, it isn't one that has that curious meme where they're trying to get everybody to absorb it and take it on.
Now, we introduced this moral lesson as the meaning of human life, but what would it, let's go back to Marcus Aurelius and in his experience while he's writing Meditations. What would he have to say about the value of human life?
Well, of course, you know, Aurelius considered Roman life, as all Romans did for the most part, to be more valuable than any other life, whether it was in Gaul, whether it was in the desert, whether it was in Judea, wherever the case may be. Romans were always more equal than others. You know, this predated Orwell by 2,000 years, as far as that conceit. Mm-hmm. So Aurelius, when he fought, for instance, I mean, his innumerable wars against the German barbarians and the Rhine and such, for some reason, not only did he discover that these moral lessons were important for Rome, but he discovered that these moral lessons were important for the military profession of arms. That's where there's been something of a cottage industry for Stoicism, where many philosophers or even serving officers and retired officers have looked at this and they've said, you know, Stoicism may be a key to a more successful and effective soldiery than any other philosophy that we could ask them to follow.
Right. Yeah. See, that's kind of that's why I was asking, too, because we're putting this now in a military context. And there's parts of Stoicism that I could see being manipulated to those ends, like this concept
all
of duty.
Of this could be.
Yes, certainly. Yes, exactly.
Certainly.
And also a kind of conformity, as it was, as I read in the first show, to the needs of society, it was almost said. And that's like very, and that could have been, you know, one author's conception of it, but it that kind of nebulous language can obviously lead to very dangerous places.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt of that. And you and I, of course, have confirmation bias, in which because of our predisposed libertarian ethos that we have, in my case, my abolitionist ethos, I use Stoicism through the lens and the bias that I'm possessed of.
Right.
Because there's no such thing as objectivity, of course. So I, of course, both consciously and unconsciously steer Stoicism and rationalize Stoicism, if I could be cruel to myself, so that it serves my libertarian ends.
Okay, so when you say there's no such thing as objectivity, would you agree with this idea that we can, without emotions involved, let's say, we can look at the world objectively, but any conception we have of reality is then colored by experience, emotion, etc.?
I think objectivity, like limited government, is a unicorn. I think it's never existed, does not exist, and will never exist because it's impossible in the human condition, because we're all equipped with our own internal biases. Mm-hmm. A variety of those biases are conscious. Some are unconscious behind closed doors that we put away for reasons that are either tragic, personal, whatever the case may be. And we don't open those doors and look at those and ask ourselves, does my unconscious bias influence the way I see the world and I apprehend the world? And then, of course, if that's me as Bill and it's you as Brett, I have to tease out when I have conversations with you, Brett, or anybody else, well, what are Brett's biases? Well, I don't know all of them and I'm making assumptions, which is why I think that instead of using this term objectivity, which I think is deceptive, mm-hmm. I would prefer to use the phrase the single most accurate picture of consensus we have between us.
Okay.
And yeah. I know that sounds awkward.
Right. And it does kind of speak to this idea of these internal editors seeing more of what we want and less of what we don't. I don't know if you know who Robert Anton Wilson is.
I do.
Yeah.
He wrote the Illuminatus trilogy.
Right. What he called reality tunnels, these thickening reality tunnels. So, yeah, I mean, there are things that obviously are interfering with objectivity greatly.
You know, governments tend to pride themselves on claiming objectivity. Like you would listen to National Pinko Radio, mm-hmm. and that's one of their predilections, is they say, well, we're not like the other commercial outlets because we don't need commercial money. Well, by the way, 70% of their money comes from commercial and corporate interests, and I think 30%, depending on the level of the NPR venue, comes from government subsidies. Do those government subsidies warp and warp the way they see the world? Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah. You and I both experienced that to a large extent. I mean, yeah, I was in the socialist beast of the military. You were in the socialist beast of the education system. Mm-hmm. And there are certain confirmation biases there that are so rock solid. you can't convince anybody to get rid of them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, I'd be worried enough about NPR just taking money from these, like, you know, think tanks and foundations, even if they had no government funding. So, yeah, that's important.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you know what? I think a lot of these I think they're dinosaur media outlets like NPR, like CBS, like NBC, like MSN, all of those, the internet has destroyed them. It's just a matter of time. You see the way newspapers are dying by the dozen every month. Right. Across the United States. Readership has just plummeted. And it hasn't plummeted because people don't want to read necessarily, although I think readership has gone down. I think it's because people sort of broke the code that newspapers will do what the government and their advertisers tell them to do, and they won't rock the boat. They won't do investigative reporting that really is interesting.
Oh, yeah. They can't rock the boat, Omo.
They can't rock the boat.
It's bad for business. They'd lose access. And their competitors, you know, you could just compete each other for the government by saying, we won't rock the boat. You know, give us access. Give us more access than the others. So because we've gone on for a while about or building off number one here, Bill, what would you say are the takeaways from this first moral lesson in the meaning of human life?
I would say that one thing that Epictetus and Seneca talk about is that we live in a tempestuous universe. Mm-hmm. We don't live on calm seas all the time.
Right.
And that because of that, there's a lot of decisions to be taken that may or may not have nice and fluffy and flowerful answers to them. And that sometimes we have to bite the bullet, as it were, and take decisions that may not quite serve our purposes, but we've really got no choice. So we just, and this is, Stoics are accused of this, they just suck it up, don't put on a frown, don't put on a grin, and just drive on. Well, to a certain extent, that's simply acceptance of what's within your, and we use this control meme all the time in Stoicism. It's simply accepting what is within your control and accepting what is without your control.
Right.
And those things without your control, how can you react to that to your own advantage instead of using emotions that are wasteful, such as anger, for instance?
Absolutely.
All of us have been angry. I've been angry. I've been angry with my children on occasion, with my wife and friends on occasion. But in the end, you know, 10 minutes later, 10 hours later, 10 days later, you reflect on the point when you were angry and you ask yourself, what did that achieve? And 99% of the time, it doesn't achieve anything.
No, it's counterproductive usually.
Exactly. And Stoics would tell you, being a master of your emotions isn't about eliminating them. It's about repressing the ones that are negative and don't do anything to make you move forward in your life in a positive way.
Now, a lot of people listening might be put off by the word repress. So
sure.
I'm trying to think of a healthy way to, I mean, we're not, repressing doesn't mean not acknowledging, right?
It does not. It means putting it in a place where you're not going to put it on display where it may hurt you later on as a result of other people thinking less of you.
Right. So
that's the way I look at it. By the way, Brett, this is what I love about your show, because you and I go on important tangents, and you bring one of my pet peeves up here, which is that I think when it comes to language, it is so critical for us to be aware of that, as you just said, with repressed and how your audience will respond to that. For instance, when I used to teach, I would ask my class in a Socratic fashion, I'm going to say a word, and I want you to raise your hand if that word makes you feel badly or you have a negative reaction to the word. So I'd say discrimination. Mm-hmm. And 3/4 of my class would put their hands up and say, yeah, that's wrong. And I would point out to them that linguistically what you've just done is you've acknowledged that before you think, you will react, and it will paint the way you view the world, because discrimination does have a bad connotation in political society when it comes to discriminating against people because of their race, their color, their creed, whatever the case may be, their sexual orientation. Yet, absent discrimination, we can't think critically.
Mm.
I mean, if we weren't able to discriminate, we couldn't have the conversation we have now. If we weren't able to divine pattern relationships, we couldn't make the advances as a society that we do now. So we have to be very careful, as you just pointed out, with that word repressed, to make sure that we take these words and we don't let the negative implications of the word overshadow our ability to use that word to make ourselves better people.
We all understand how our thoughts become our words, right? But few people understand how their words can also become their thoughts.
Absolutely.
When,
I mean, we're English speakers.
Right, exactly.
So we have those biases.
So do we want to move on to the second moral lesson?
We should. I got a lot of this from my reading of the Stoics for that 600-year period and some of what Irvine and Holiday and others have done in the past 50 years. What I found interesting in this was there's a magazine called Quadrant put out by the Australian Army. Mm-hmm. And there was this author who talked about how Stoicism can be used as a positive measure in military performance. And these eight moral lessons that I found, some of those come from there. And one of the things they talk about as the second moral lesson in Quadrant is how a military professional should face his day. Now, that's the way it reads, but it doesn't. We could take away that notion of the military professional, because what we can do is we can ask ourselves, how do we face our day? This is the second moral lesson. This is where you get up from that time you've been sleeping. You have a new day ahead of you. What are you going to do to make that day not only productive for yourself, but for everybody around you? And by the way, you're not doing this altruistically. You're doing this out of your own self-interest, because you and I are both aware, and I'm repeating something that I think I said in the first episode, capitalism is that perfect system in which two complete strangers can come together and they can divine a transaction for goods and services. And as a result of that, they can say, you know what? Let's do this. They never unholster their weapons. They leave happy. They exchange business cards, and they'll do it again. The government can't do this. The government always has to use a threat of violence or violence. Capitalism is this meme and this way of human beings coming together in a very civilized fashion where they keep their guns at their sides or their rifles slung. They have these great transactions, and they walk away, and hopefully they'll have more business, and both of them are better for having done that. So I don't want your audience to come away from this thinking that, oh, Stoicism only applies to military professionals in this case. Not at all, but it's just that military professionals tend to be very assertive and methodical about the way they approach a day, a week, a month, a year, because it's all about, when you break everything down, how are campaigns conducted in peacetime and wartime.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you could find parts of that in Napoleon Hill. What's the Master Key to Riches, or Think and Grow Rich, yeah. Right? That was one of his most important lessons, was, you know, adding value for other people in furtherance of your own success.
You know, no one has penned more ink on the concept of honor than Eastern and Western militaries over the past 3,000 years.
Yeah.
That's where you usually find the notions teased out and talked about. And of course, I think that honor is not only tangential, but central to the Stoic philosophy, because honor, as they said in the movie Rob Roy, Liam Neeson would say, honor is a gift a man gives to himself.
Right.
I think there's a lot to be teased out of that very simple phrase that applies to what we're talking about here. But what Aurelius is basically talking about in the second moral lesson is he's saying, how can we be volitional, free moral agents who begin our day, much like Brett does in meditation, or begin our day by planning out what can we not do, not only to be effective, but to benefit those around us? Because if I benefit everybody around me, I'm not being a good altruist. What I'm saying is, I want to have future interaction with you so that we both benefit and this marches forward into the undiscovered country.
List making is a great strategy here. I do it every morning.
Oh, I think it is. You know, Aurelius would tell us that daily moral life is about honorable action.
Yes.
And honorable action, in the case of the Stoics, for your audience who listened to part one and part two, honor is being able to look at yourself in the mirror and know that at the conclusion of your day, you've done the right thing by you and by others throughout the day.
Yes, absolutely. And the reason why I say list making is I don't make lists and throw them away. As far as like having this mirror, we talked in an earlier show about this program, Evernote. Every day I wake up, I open the program and I make a little note with today, whatever the date is, and I start a checklist. I have kept every single one of these, as I mentioned in an earlier show with this question, if somebody asked me, what did you do on your birthday this year? And I can tell them the things I did. I can review these, you know, I can see the interactions that I had with people or the things that I did for the show or that I did for others or that I did for myself. I like having that record. You know, it's a useful checklist on a daily basis for daily planning, but there is also a record of, you know, GTD, getting things done.
That's fantastic. And you do it virtually, and I do it the old pen and paper way. And I must have 3 to 5 notebooks that I maintain for different concerns that I have throughout the day and the week. And I even also, and I recommend everybody do this, is carry a small notebook in your pocket everywhere you go.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So that is number two. Let's move on to the third one.
So this imparts the central tenet of Stoicism, and that's knowing what one control and what one cannot control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this really is from the University of the Intuitively Obvious.
Right.
And it is sort of redundant with the other shows we've done. But I can't emphasize this enough as the tenet that will liberate so many people from things that may irritate them on a daily basis or a weekly basis. I can't tell you the number of friends and family I have who they'll come to me and they'll say, oh, I've got the following problems and such. And then when I sort of distill it down on reflection, you know, myself or in conversation with them, it turns out that they're butting their heads against the wall, trying to change somebody or something that they have no control over.
Right.
Talk about an ineffective use of your time. As a you and I are both writers, mm-hmm. and you're a venerated podcaster.
Right.
There's a lot of work that goes into doing this, but fortunately, it's a lot of work. You need to rely on others to a certain extent for technical support. But as writers, you and I, we're in our heads, we're transmitting from our heads, and of course, being writers, I think it makes us smarter people, if I may be so bold, because when you commit something to paper and you conduct your revisions and you conduct your editing, you start to see where you may be wrong, where what you've read may be incorrect, or what you've read may be correct. You start expanding on that. It just makes your thinking clearer.
Yeah.
Being a writer.
You know, I was unpacking some boxes of books last night. We talked about this before, and I stopped you because you said you're a writer, and I said, uh-huh. And then I told you, well, I don't really like to write, but I found these notebooks from the earlier days of the show, and I was shocked how much I had written. You know, like, like not scripts, but notes, mind maps, like just committing ideas to paper. I had notebooks full of stuff from the first, you know, 100, 150 shows that I did. And I was like, wow, I actually have written quite a lot. I had these two giant binders filled with notes for teaching history. So it's interesting. Yeah, I stumbled on all this stuff just last night.
And I've done the same. And when we're talking about control, can we control our own thinking, and can we expand our own thinking by our own volition? Of course we can.
Mm-hmm.
Can I? And I mentioned in another program, I feel genuinely bad about marine mammals being used for food.
Sure.
But there's not much I can do about that. So it can concern me, but I can't dedicate my life to that. But what I can dedicate parts of my life to is things that may not be in control, but things that I can influence. For instance, I think that through my writing at ZeroGov.com, and I think more greatly through what you do at the School Sucks Project with your podcasting, you and I are philosophically terraforming the planet one disobedient surf at a time.
Yes.
We're asking people to reflect. We're asking people to examine their own lives and say, you're in control of this. You have this sphere of influence that's a meter around you, and you can control everything that you do. And if you don't think that you can, you're misinformed, because it's up to you to do everything that you do as a free moral agent. But you don't have such great control over, let's say, the hunting of whales or the abuse of dogs or something like that. But here's what you do have control over. Let's suppose I don't like the cop murders of dogs that go on. As you know, one of my pet peeves, of course, is the cockroach madness that happens in the United States. And I probably spend 1/3 of the essays that I pen at ZeroGov.com on the police state in America and just how awful it is. Is it in my control to change the police state in America? It is completely out of my control. Can I influence people, though, through my writing with the thoughts that I have? I absolutely can. So that's my small, I guess, bridge, you can call it, mm-hmm. of how I take things that are out of my control, in this case, the police state in the U.S., and how I can take what's in my control, my own cognitive sensibilities and my own philosophical predilections, and I'm hoping to use those to influence others through my writing medium or like you do with your podcasting medium.
Right, yeah.
So it's taking our control, and it's extending the control that we have out to see what people think in a voluntary fashion about what our ideas are about. Because the contest of ideas is one that is constantly in the fray. And it's not going to go away. And if we don't try to influence that contest, then we're not going to have much influence at all.
Yeah, you know, in the last, really in the last year and a half, 2 years, I've become much more concerned than I used to be with measurement, you know, as far as the reach of the show, the impact of the show. When I was a tutor, I mean, when I was a teacher, that was a whole other frustration. But when I was a tutor, like specifically for the SAT, measurement was very clear. I could look at somebody's scores before they worked with me and look at their scores after and see at least one kind of impact that I had had. Hopefully, the impact had been broader than just score improvements. Like, they found the experience enriching. They realized, you know, there might be some valuable skills that they learned from the experience, that it wasn't just a waste of their time to get two numbers to put on a college application. So the measurements were very clear. I knew I was competent, right? So the podcast just kind of goes out there to strangers, you know, and you don't really know what is happening. So I started to track likes, shares, percentage of people who were willing to donate on a regular basis. We prepared a survey where we, you know, went out to get listener feedback. And that was, it had a great clarifying effect as far as like what my impact was. I think that a lot of people, and I say this because this was my experience at one time. I wanted to talk about the save the whales types of changes because I could, you know, feel like I was doing something, but never have to worry about it being measured in any objective sense, you know, in any real feedback kind of sense, right? It's like these people, oh gosh, Twitter. You know, the cause of the week, the cause of the week kind of thing, right? Ice bucket challenges and stop Coney and all that stuff, right? None of that, your impact, the people who are doing that, you're just doing it, right? You'll be on to something else a week later. So I felt like if the show is going to be me battling the Department of Education or 100 years of, you know, backroom agendas, that's going to lead to feelings of smallness, you know? So to turn the show into something that's more practical and useful was very important because I felt like there was a better chance of measuring that and seeing what my sphere of control actually could be. And also, in this sense anyway, how it could expand.
Maybe you should consider your show to be something of a long-term venture. Mm-hmm. In other words, Stuart Brand, who wrote the Whole Earth Catalog and edited the, I think it was a Whole Earth Review and Coevolution Quarterly, he runs something called the Long Now Foundation. And what that's all about is preserving the knowledge that we have today, whether in electronic or permanent mediums, for the future in one fashion or another. For the longest time, ever since Gutenberg designed it, reading has been the fundamental transmission medium for knowledge and information.
Yeah.
And today, as a result of the things that you do with podcasting, I think this audio medium, I don't think it'll supersede it. I think it will ride alongside reading as a transmission medium for either gaining knowledge, expanding knowledge, whatever the case may be. If you look to every show that you do, and when I do shows with you and when I do shows with other folks, I try to think to myself, not only am I going to have an impact daily with the show, but if somebody unearths this a month from now, a year from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, is there value to their life or their examined life as a result of listening to this or reading what I write? And I try to keep that in mind. I hope that doesn't sound hubristic, but I think that's a good thing to do when you and I are in the commerce of ideas primarily. That's what I don't do it for a living. I wish I could, but I don't get paid enough for it. So this is like an avocation for me. But we are influencers and idea disseminators. I mean, we love the dialogue, the conversation, the kind of getting your intellectual juices flowing with these various Socratic dialogues that we engage in. And I'm hoping, much like Dan Carlin's history podcast on hardcore history, that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, maybe 100 years from now, somebody will dig up what Brett has podcast, you know, whether it's with me or with Thaddeus Russell or somebody else, and they'll say, there's value for where I'm living now, even though it's 100 years hence, for what they're saying then. Because we suffer from this chronological hubris where we think that because we live here in this moment in 2014, right here, right now, whatever anybody thought in 1899 is worthless and not worthwhile whatsoever. Well, that's silly. On its face, it's silly. And you look at the horizontal and vertical integration that we have with knowledge today available to us through the interwebs and books and Kindle and things like that. Every human being has more exposure to more knowledge than any human being who's ever preceded them. And what are people doing with it? Well, they're not doing what they should have. I have to stop myself from saying that because I should never say should unless it has I in front of it, because then I'm being too presumptuous. But I just think that we're abusing this great gift that we have of knowledge that abounds, this ocean of knowledge, and using it to further our particular ideas and influence of ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just to go back, I do look at this show that way. Because it helps me deal with frustration sometimes. You know, if I put out something that's a lot of work and I say, 1,500 people heard this, well, gosh, you know. But then I start thinking, okay, well, what will it be in 10 years?
And I've got to remind you of something too, Brett, and mm-hmm. this happens with my writing. You've touched 1,500 minds. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Most of those minds, especially in the small community that we inhabit, this little sanctuary of libertarianism that we're in, they love to have conversations about ideas.
Yeah.
So you haven't just exposed it to 1,500 people, because all, let's say two-thirds of those people talk to friends, family, community, like-minded friends who haven't listened to your show, and they're expanding. I mean, what I discover is that Mortimer Adler wrote How to Read a Book. There's
yep.
four levels of reading,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to belabor that point, but the fourth level is syncretic, where if I read 5, 7, 10 books on the same subject and I actively interrogate those authors in my mind while I'm being an active reader, I can become just as smart as those authors as a result of saying, well, wait, that's inconsistent with what two of the authors said. And why is that? I examine the footnotes, and then I'll examine other footnotes, and then I'll read another book. But I'm staying on the same rabbit hole necessarily. I'm simply getting smarter about that subject in both depth and breadth as a result of the active reading and interrogation that I do of it. Mm-hmm. And I think this happens with your audience members, where they'll have a conversation and they'll make these intellectual discoveries. Well, oh, I've made that connection, because I'm paraphrasing here, one of the markers of genius is combining things now that have never been combined before. And I think to a certain extent, Malcolm Gladwell does that. We have great thinkers like Einstein and Copernicus and Galileo and Alan Turing mm-hmm. from that new movie, The Imitation Game, which I recommend everybody see. Stephen Hawking. You look at all these great minds, of course they're preternaturally brilliant. But one of the things that they do is they take combinations of pattern relationships that haven't been done before.
Right.
From whence they can draw premises, from whence they can draw conclusions, and then they can start to infer from those conclusions other things. And right. I think that's what – there's a force multiplier effect with what you do, Brett, and what people do when they write.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So you may touch on 1,500, but I'll bet you're touching on a whole lot more than that as a result of the fire that you've lit inside their minds.
That is exactly what I like to think. That helps yeah. me. That motivates me.
Sure.
So, but the idea of understanding what the sphere of influence is, or the sphere of control, because there's a whole other different question when it comes to just me, right? Like, being able to do this gives me a very clear sphere of control. I am so grateful that there's so many other, you know, challenges that I used to have in life related to making money that I don't have to deal with anymore, you know? My sphere is very set by what I've decided to do. And I understand, and I remember like bringing work home with me. And I've like tried to help. I think we even talked about this earlier in the series, like listening to other people come home and just continue to talk about people at work, you know, like, why are you giving them your free time? You know, it's bad enough that you have to deal with them there. So
I don't think your audience realizes how profound that is, what you just said.
Okay.
I think they will once they grok it. But that is so critically important. Whatever people are doing to impoverish their own lives intellectually, spiritually, philosophically, a Stoic would tell you, if you're letting that affect your own life, then you're not worth living the good life.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think you're dead on. You know, I'd like to quote Epictetus on this whole thing about control, because no one says it better than the Stoics themselves. Plus, the great thing about quote, and I said this in another episode, is that when I come up with these really pithy quotations and I read them, it makes me sound smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the things within our power are naturally at our disposal, free from any restraint or hindrance. But those things outside our power are weak, dependent, or determined by the whims and actions of others, as you just described. For instance, let's bring this into the real world. How many times have you seen the media talk about student debt, where you see these numbskulls holding up signs that say, I have an MA in women's studies and I'm $160,000 in debt?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what the Stoic would tell that person, and it could be mechanical engineering, by the way, and you've got I do diminish women's studies and things, because I think those are silly degrees. But if that's what you want to do, please show me one incident in American history where a student was forced to sign for that loan.
Yeah.
There's none. And a Stoic would tell you, well, you've made your own bed in this case. You're seeking relief from your bad decisions.
How do you feel about the knowledge problem that exists there? And I will just tangent into this for a minute, because it is very relevant to something that comes up on the show a lot, which is student loans, college debt, the relevance of college in the going into the 21st century. Most people are really sold a bill of goods in high school. The best knowledge that they have available at the time is this idea that you're not successful unless you go to college. But good news, on the other side of college, there is a job that will make paying off these loans no big deal. I mean, what I was told when I graduated from high school in 1995.
Just what you said, though. It's a bill of goods.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's all it is.
So the idea that don't worry. Oh, yes, this might seem like a lot. And, you know, it's never I was being interviewed about this yesterday, that most people, you know, you're right. I'm listening to myself say this, and it doesn't change where the responsibility lies. But I think there is some nuance there. Right. After 15,000 hours of going to government school and being told what's good and what leads to success, a lot of people don't have the right information to make the proper decision when it comes to taking on that debt.
I have a master's degree, and I got a bachelor's degree a whole lot of time between getting both of those.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that it was to my advantage in the curious career field that I'm in to do so, and it has benefited me to a certain extent. But my children, for instance, I tell them, unless you can go to school without debt or with very little debt, it is not worth your time, because you won't get the return unless you are a scientist or an engineer. For instance, my oldest son has an MS in mechanical engineering and left after almost 7 years of schooling, because it's 5 years to get your undergrad in mechanical engineering and 2 years for the MS, with $7,000 in debt total.
Yeah.
Because of scholarships, he had been home educated. He's preternaturally bright. All the rest of that, but he left with very little debt. And as a mechanical engineer, it's hard not to find a job, unlike a lot of these other majors that are out there. But if you're majoring in the humanities or the liberal arts or something like that, you could buy a set of the great books of the Western world. I prefer the 54-volume set to the 60-volume re-edited version for $100 on the internet, probably shipped.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read those books and take it upon yourself to go in a very concerted and methodical effort to go through those books, which will lead you to other books, you're, as a humanities or liberal arts major in a in a major college, whether it's Ivy League or a state school, I think you will get the equivalent, especially if you get involved in discussion groups and reading groups. You know, one thing that we've done with our children, for instance, if it's outside of our competence to teach it in home education, I outsource by contracting a tutor.
Right.
And that's a whole lot less expensive than having $160,000 in debt. I don't think college degrees outside of science and engineering pay off.
Oh, yeah.
I think it is a bill of goods.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I was just interested in your thoughts on that.
Sure. But the student loan thing just, it makes my head explode because, you know, there's a reason why the federal government took on all the debt. There's a reason why that debt cannot be discharged in a bankruptcy court. It's yet another way for the government to get their talons in you for more money to be sucked out of your lifeblood and transferred to them.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we see how just even monetary policy in this country discourages savings. Right.
Well, yes, it does.
When people have savings, what are they? They're resourceful. They're independent, you know, and they're probably people who would be, you know, maybe if they had a greater level of financial security or comfort, they might be more willing to recognize problems. Right. Because I've had people tell me, yeah, Brett, that's nice. How good for you that you have time to think about these things. Most people don't. Most people aren't left with that. You know?
And they work 40, 60, maybe 80 hours a week to pay for all of these material possessions and debt instruments that they signed on to voluntarily.
Right.
You know, I don't buy new cars, even if I were a millionaire, which I'm not. I probably wouldn't buy a new car because it just doesn't make sense to me for a conveyance. We rent a house now. For the longest time, I owned houses. I wish on reflection I could have all that money back because I bought into that nonsense about the American dream of home ownership and such. So, yeah, and the government encourages that kind of behavior that harnesses people for their entire working lives to paying off debts they've incurred for present consumption.
You know, there's an interesting tie-in here to this third moral lesson that we were talking about too, right? Like the world, what can you do? How influential could you really be when you feel like your own world is closing in on you? You know,
absolutely,
and that keeps people small and controlled. And you know, Noam Chomsky said the same thing that you just said about student loan debt. You know, that this is a tool of control.
I mean, they teach state idolatry in all of these government schools. And by the way, all colleges and universities in America are government schools, with the exception of two, Grove City College and Hillsdale.
Mm-hmm.
All of them are federal institutions.
Right.
Much like all 19,000 police departments in the United States are de facto and de jure federal police entities because of what they do on a daily basis, where they get their monies and what laws they're upholding.
Right.
Same thing applies to universities.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. The fourth lesson deals with how happiness can only be found within. I repeat, happiness can only be found within. What that means is that if you allow other people to make you happy, the Stoic would say you are merely a puppet. There is no possible way for you to define true happiness unless it comes from within. And let me address another pet peeve I have about the government education system.
Mm-hmm.
All the noise you hear about self-esteem.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Self-esteem is an artificial construct, because what self-esteem is it's other people telling you to feel good about yourself because other people said so. The distinction between that and self-respect is that self-respect is very stoic in that it comes from within. And your ability to look at yourself in the mirror every morning or at the conclusion of the day and know that you did the right thing by yourself and by others is proof enough that your self-respect is there.
Yeah.
Self-esteem is a wholly owned subsidiary of the state, in my mind, where they're constantly peppering you with this notion of what your perception should be of yourself.
This was one of our criticisms when we did that series, that the term self-esteem was really, I mean, I understand your argument about being a wholly owned subsidiary of the state. It was hijacked by the New Age movement as well. And it was really just about the way we described it in the show, a kind of acceptance of powerlessness, which I don't like. And what Nathaniel Brandon described in his book, self-esteem is a label we put to practices that we do, right? It's not a sticker that we get when we pleased other people. These are practices, it's measurable, and it is entirely internal.
Well, let's look at the use of the word esteem in American and English vocabulary. You hear it most often said in this fashion, that person is held in very high esteem. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that projections of esteem are what make for what that person's perception is and not how that person perceives themselves. For instance, I think a lot of politicians, the Clintons, for instance, don't exist in their own minds unless they're acknowledged by other people. And I think a lot of politicians suffer from that, in that they think that their power, their WASTA, derives from people's recognition of who they are and their place in life and their place at the podium and what esteem they're held in. That's why I think that, you know, respect, like I can certainly respect you, Brett, and other luminaries and folks in the Liberty Movement with no hesitation whatsoever. But in the end, whether I respect you or not, it's irrelevant, because in order for me to have respect for myself, how would I know how to respect you unless I knew how to do it to myself?
Sure. But this question of what other people think of us, is it a valuable feedback loop to you? Reputation, respect? See, I just think there's this totally being a people pleaser, or the way you describe the Clintons is at one extreme, right? But then
they're sycophants. They use feces as one of their five food groups.
Exactly. Yeah. But then at the other end, and I've certainly encountered these people, like, I don't care what anyone thinks of me, you know?
Oh, you know, I have to say on my own behalf, I'm especially concerned about having a reputation as an honorable individual, which I think you would be the same kind of person.
Right.
But I also think that the sum of that should be my own self-respect, and in the end, coming from me as a result of doing the right thing.
Right. Well, I think if you are a self-respecting person, you attract the like, you know?
I think so too.
And then so too. Reputation matters, right? Yeah. To a certain extent, right? That's being mirrored back, that you are self-respecting, therefore you're attracting similar people into your life. It's very easy to understand why cops hang around with cops and heroin addicts don't hang around with joggers and so on and so forth, right? So you attract the like, and then because you've attracted those people through your own virtuous action, it would matter what people like that think of you.
I agree, and this segues brilliantly into the fifth lesson, which is that the argument that events do not necessarily hurt us, but our views of them can.
Mm-hmm.
So your perceptions of the world around you and how that divines from self-respect, how that divines from how you conduct yourself on a daily basis, how that divines from your ability to see control as those certain things that you can control and not those things that are outside of your sphere of influence. So your very perception of that is going to paint how you entreat with the world as a result of it.
Okay, so if somebody is allowing his or herself to be controlled by these externals, it says a lot about his or her conception of self, I think.
Yes.
Right?
It does. And fundamentally, what really intrigues me about this particular notion is that absent obedience and absent a forwarding of our refusal as a human race to every government that ever comes to us and tries through violence and threat of violence to make us do what they want and not what we want, if that withdrawal of obedience and that advancing of our refusal occurred, which is this Stoic lesson, no government could exist on earth outside of self-government.
Right.
This is one of those critical junctures that led me to embark on this book project next year, where I'm going to try to find the linkages between Stoicism and modern libertarianism and abolitionism, because I think that there are deep roots and confluences there that match up rather nicely.
All right. So one of the things that I think is a big part of number five is maybe the confronting of fear, right? When we go back to that idea of self-conception, if a person has these externals looming over them, I think it might say something about, you know, unconfronted fears, unresolved pain. and that's contributing to a lesser sense of self.
And this is because of a Stoic viewpoint that death, and again from the University of the Intuitively Obvious, that death is a natural part of the human experience.
Right.
And that the acceptance of that termination is not something to be feared, because you gain nothing from fearing death. If you come to grips with it, things will be that much better for you, and you'll have that much more time with the finite time and resources we have in our lives between now and the time that we assume room temperature to get the things done that we want to, instead of shivering in a corner, fearing the inevitability of death, which is pretty foolish in my mind.
Yeah, I think that, that acceptance in general pays great dividends in things like, purposeful living, a sense of responsibility, self-responsibility.
Well, look at Gandhi. Mm-hmm. I think that Gandhi had a very intimate, close, detailed, and I wouldn't say fatalistic, but willing acceptance of death as a part of the journey that he was on. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he would not have been able to do what he did and what he accomplished. And I think Gandhi is one of thousands of historical figures where one of my favorite leadership figures of all time is Ernest Shackleton. And I think that he also practiced a Stoic lifestyle, and he also practiced an acceptance of death as this inevitability, that it's going to happen. So why bother yourself with it? Once again, it speaks to span of control. Do I have the ability to control my mortality so that I live far longer than I should? Biologically and philosophically, I simply don't. So why bother myself with it?
Yeah. Let's have
an
adventure.
Why not have a good death?
Exactly. Now, if I'm remembering the name correctly, he was the one who went to Antarctica, right?
Shackleton. Yeah. He got marooned there for almost 4 years.
That's right. That's right.
World War I. Yep.
Right. So with all this accepted, why not pioneer to this place where human beings are most likely to die?
Exactly.
The number one place on the planet for.
Yeah. Especially as a former military professional, the Stoic viewpoint of death as a natural adjunct of life is practically beneficial to your trade.
Sure.
Because you just take the assumption that at any one time, you can assume room temperature as a result of your duties. There's Michael Snook, who wrote about Asandilwana and Rorke's Drift in 1879 when the British were fighting the Zulu. The 1st of the 24th Regiment of Foot was annihilated to almost a man. It was the highest British colonial or British regular army fatality rate against native warriors they'd ever suffered in their entire history. And Michael Snook wrote a book called What Better Way Can Men Die? And the title alone speaks to the fact that when you look at Victorian England and you look at a lot of these historical antecedents of warrior cultures like the Romans, for them, death may not have necessarily been something they looked forward to, but they were comfortable with it in that they didn't bother themselves with cowering in a corner and worrying about it. They just looked at it as an occupational hazard.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So number six.
Character matters more than reputation. There may be things that you do that everybody else will interpret as the wrong thing, but it is right by you.
What would be the measurements for that?
Well, for instance, if you look at Howard Spring's 1940 novel, Fame as a Spur, it tells the story of the rise of an idealistic British working class politician by the name of Hamer Radshaw. Mm-hmm. And in pursuit of higher office, he's corrupted and he's renouncing every principle he ever espoused and every person who ever placed faith in him. Making a cavalry saber his honor symbol, he gradually allows its blade to lie dormant in its scabbard. At the end of his life, resplendent with accumulated honors and a peerage, he tries to remove the sword, but it's rusted in the scabbard. And the metaphor there is that the career in which Bradshaw literally sold his soul rusted in his body as a result of pursuing reputation outside of his character. Now, in this case, we have to remember that Bradshaw, a British politician, seeks reputation among fellow politicians. And I would say that I'm accurate when I say, Brett, on this show, that you and I think that politicians are among the lowest form of life on earth. mm-hmm. if not the universe, mm-hmm. in what they do. Because basically what they are is emissaries of a death cult. That's yes. what all politics is, ultimately. And these are simply practitioners, not only who aren't simply bureaucrats, but they are also the ones who make this death cult work, who make this horrific system of violence work, and who rationalize this alien way of being outside of Stoic circles, which is the political way, the politician's way of life. So in this case, this is where they took their reputation and they said, well, I'm going to let my character be burnished, because as a politician, if you let your character be burnished, it doesn't matter as long as your reputation as a working politician is intact. You'll notice, though, in military professions, this tends not to be the case. If your audience saw the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson,
yep.
there was this ahistorical and artistic license taken to painting the British colonel who was told at one point by the commanding general of the British Army at the time, when he had him in his studio and he was having a hard time fighting these rebels. He said, what you do in the conduct of your campaign, where you are going to practice unrestricted warfare, where you are going to lay waste to farms and you're going to maim and kill women and children, you can never go back to England. If anybody remembers hearing that in the film. What he meant was he can never go back as a military professional with that reputation. He has burnished his character, but his reputation is intact in that little microcosm, but he certainly can't go back to England as a reputable individual. Character is far more important than reputation in Stoic circles, but I do think there are ways in which we can measure our character that benefits our reputation.
Sure.
It's sort of subtle the way you have to tease this out, but if this lesson tells you anything, it tells you that if you sacrifice your character in order to gain reputation among a select few or such, you are not living a Stoic life.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense, that distinction between character and reputation?
Of course. I think a lot of people, I know I certainly have had experiences where actions have been rationalized by saying, only I will know.
You know, and character is what you do with yourself in the dark when no one's looking.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, just to go back to Brandon's book, he points that out. He says, who matters more? You know, this is you that we're talking about. Why would you want these dirty little secrets with yourself? You know, you're the one who has to deal with them. So,
or lock them away, and what's going to happen when you lock them away. And exactly.
Right, yeah. Right, absolutely.
So the seventh lesson, Brett, in the Stoic world, effective leadership and good conduct are always dependent on a conscious decision. And let me take a quick segue here on unconscious incompetence all the way to unconscious competence. There's four levels to that. And maybe one, I'll bet some enterprising members of the audience could tease out even more sub-levels of each one.
Sure.
But it goes from the level of unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence to unconscious competence. And of course, the last one that I just mentioned is the one that we all seek in every aspect of our lives if we are to do things well. Much like what the Japanese would refer to in their Bushido code, where no matter how banal the task is before you, whether you are an archer or a spearman, or you make sushi, or you make shoes, whatever the case may be, you do it to the very best ability that you can. And what that means is that you have a conscious decision to renounce self-conceit and arrogance. Mm-hmm. In other words, let the product of what you do, whether it's the spoken word, whether you're a rifleman, whether you're a program manager, whatever it is that you do, let your deeds speak to themselves instead of you speaking about your deeds and letting that be the totality of why you do what you do. I mean, your deeds are going to speak for yourself. For instance, Brett, your podcast, you've done over 300 podcasts, if I recall. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah.
You've done over 300. I think that body of work speaks for itself. It's not something where Brett has to go out and say, you need to listen to my podcast because I'm so good. All Brett has to do is say, you need to listen to my podcast and divine from those what you wish, and I think you'll be happy with what you hear.
Absolutely. Now, something that I do pretty frequently is reiterate what I feel is the mission and the importance of the show. How do you feel about that?
No, I think that's just fine.
Okay.
I mean, because all you're doing is you're basically calling attention to those things that you have identified as beneficial to others, because you and I are self-proclaimed capitalist, abolitionist, anarchist, whatever the case may be. And the way we see the world is that what we produce is in our self-interest. We're not doing it for altruistic reasons. We're not doing it to serve anybody but our self-interest.
Yeah.
But one curious thing you and I have noticed is that if in serving our self-interest, we serve others, for instance, in the marketplace, karma really comes around if you do it in a good, proper, conscious fashion where not only are you trying to be virtuous, but you're trying to give the best bang for your buck to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Not because you're necessarily motivated purely by profit, although I see nothing wrong with that. The thing is, what you want is repeat customers, and you want your reputation quotient to remain in the stratosphere.
Yes.
So that's the way I see that. And of course, and I've said this several times, and if I'm a broken record, Brett, I apologize. What you and I are touching on in these four podcasts that we're going to do, this is three of four, on Stoicism, is just the tip of the iceberg. This is just the very narrow patina of the surface of this entire conversation that people can have with themselves and with their friends and family and community and whoever is interested in Stoicism and the like for the rest of their lives to achieve a kind of mastery in their own realm.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said before, I was really satisfied. The more I read, the more I realized, how many of these things I was already doing, because I realized the positive results that they produced.
You know, for instance, my wife, I've mentioned this before, is an instinctual libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a built-in genetic Celtic anti-authoritarianism
mm-hmm.
that didn't quite manifest itself intellectually, not because my wife isn't bright, because she's very bright. It's just that it isn't something that she dug into. Once she established an intellectual foundation, a rationale for why she felt so instinctually anti-authoritarian, it made it that much richer and deeper as a abolitionist tapestry, when you look at it that way. Because not only are you confirming, well, that's why my heart has felt the way it has all the time, because you can marry the mind and the spirit and the heart together, and you discover, well, it does make sense.
Yeah, it's really nice when you can put a label to things, because I think that's the beginning of obviously producing a method for doing those things continuously and successfully.
It's the most positive use of discrimination on planet Earth.
Absolutely. So okay, we just have one left here.
We do. It would be the eighth and final lesson, and that concerns the question of where your line of goodness is in your life. And what I'd like to do is quote Alexander Solzhenitsyn in The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And I recommend his, I call it a companion volume to that, which is called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And it's also a smaller book. Solzhenitsyn writes, "It was only when I lay there on the rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not between states, nor between classes, nor between political parties, but right through every human heart, through all human hearts. And that is why I turn back to the years of my imprisonment and say, bless you, prison, for having been in my life." Now, what he's saying basically is that here he is at one of the, what most people would posit as the worst position one can be in life, which is where your liberty, your freedom, your body is caged, quite literally in this case, caged and gulagged. Yet from that, much like there was a prisoner, he was a boxer, he became a prisoner, and Ryan Holiday talks about him. He was called the Hurricane.
Yes,
Ryan Holiday talks about him in The Obstacle's Way, where he went to prison, but he went to prison on his own terms. And I think to a certain extent, that's what happened here. Now, we don't have to go to prison to experience what this is. We can look at what happened to Solzhenitsyn and what happened to Hurricane and the rest of them and say, I don't really want to be in a cage, but I can learn the life lessons that they learned by trying to apply that to my own life. And what Solzhenitsyn is basically trying to communicate is that the good that we have in this life comes from our self-respect, our own character, our own virtue, and how we practice as individuals in the world with the people around us and with ourselves.
Well, what about this other side of the heart?
Well, of course, that I estimate that 3 to 5 to 7% of a given population in the West is given to psychopathy and sociopathy of a certain extent. And I think probably a large percentage, if not the lion's share, if not almost all of them, of politicians, for instance, and bureaucrats tend to be on that side of, mm-hmm. of this good and bad heart complex. I think maybe they don't come to work every day saying, I'm going to do evil in this world, but I think that they come to work every day justifying and rationalizing the evil that they do and putting another label on it.
And that's been one of the struggles that I've had on the show, is really trying to understand maybe some of the people, a recent struggle, trying to understand the motives and trying to put these people in the context of their time, the people who shaped the schooling system in America. It's so easy to talk about so many different groups of planners or, you know, the socialists, the progressives, the bureaucrats as evil. But it was too reductive because I was missing all of these opportunities to really broaden my understanding of what was going on. So I think this eighth one is really valuable, and it's worth keeping in mind, you know, regardless of who we're talking about or thinking about.
You know, Brett, I've really come to the conclusion on examination of history, you know, back almost 3,000 years in Western history, that a lot of the people who we call evil and despots have managed to convince themselves in what they do, even when they're murdering and killing people by the millions, in the case of the communists and the socialists, or in the case of the eradication of the American Aboriginals, maybe these bureaucrats and elected officials in D.C. and their concomitant armies that they sent forth over the plains to eradicate Aboriginal Americans, maybe they didn't wake up every day and say, I'm going to do evil things today. What they were doing is they were justifying and rationalizing what they were doing, probably in a very high-level fashion of why they did what they did for the good of all. But I do think, to a certain extent, whenever you put anything but I in front of should, that leads to evil consequences, because the impossible moral equation that captures so many statists is that they really think that if they use immoral means, it will eventually yield moral ends. And that is an impossible equation when you look through history.
The other thing, too, is that it's very anti-Stoic. You know, one of the things we were talking about in Stoicism, I believe, in the last show was, I think the way it was framed was conforming your will to basically the order of nature. And we see so many of these people trying to conform, in their mind, I think, trying to conform nature to their will.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. You know, I look at William Wilberforce, for instance, at the end of the 18th century, the early 19th century in England. He's a member of Parliament. He's a devout Christian, and he's a devout abolitionist of the highest order. And he's standing there in the Parliament saying, the ownership of other human beings, despite having a biblical imprimatur, and let's put ourselves chronologically in this era, you know, being a biblical man, whatever that interpretation may be, was extraordinarily important in the American polity and in the English polity at the time, in this snapshot of history. And he's standing there, and what the devout Christian William Wilberforce is basically saying is, he's saying, in spite of this biblical imprimatur that is given to slavery, I have come to the conclusion that the ownership of other human beings is not God's will. He established an interpretation of that. But imagine, I would say, the Stoic courage it took for Wilberforce to know that he would be marginalized as a result of espousing what he felt so deeply he had to do, no matter the cost to him politically.
That's interesting. That story makes me, through a kind of roundabout way here, want to revisit a concept that we talked about earlier in this discussion. I think this is important just for the sake of clarity for my listeners. We used the word repression before.
Yes.
And I wanted to share the definition. Of course, the first one is the action of subduing someone or something by force, the restraint, prevention, or inhibition of a feeling, quality, etc., or the action or process of suppressing a thought or desire in oneself so that it remains unconscious. So we are talking about somebody who, against what was convenient, spoke up against what was wrong, correct?
He did, and he put himself in the professional hazard, in the, he subjected himself to ridicule. Gandhi did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Churchill did the same thing in 1920 with his Amritsar speech, which I think is one of the most extraordinary speeches he ever did in his lifetime. And this is from a very able rhetorician, despite the fact that if you go to my site, zerogov.com, I rip Winston Churchill as being a consummate statist of the highest order and a man who I think may not have thought himself evil, but did evil deeds throughout his entire political career. But there was this one shining moment for him with this Amritsar speech where he spoke against the British massacre in India at Jallianwala Bagh, where they estimate thousands of Indian civilians were killed by British soldiers in a protest. And it was a shining moment. But then I guess it was his moment of moral sobriety, and then he sunk into his moral drunkenness that was influenced by his childlike reverence for the power of the state, his flirtation with socialist and Fabian policies despite his protestations otherwise and things like that. So I think maybe there are people like Wilberforce who take their shoulder, put it into the wheel, and they dedicate themselves for the entirety of their life despite the cost to them to do that. And then you have people where you have a flash in the pan like Churchill, such an able rhetorician, having his shining moment. But then the bookend is what he's done previously and what he's done after that is nothing but unadorned evil.
Right. So there is this stoic aspect of these stories, doing the right thing no matter the cost, right?
And Wilberforce is a stoic hero of mine, even though I think consciously Wilberforce would have never acknowledged that he was being stoic.
But there's also this opportunity for a perversion of one of the tenets of stoicism, which would be conforming your mind to reality, right?
Right.
So I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, and I'm sorry to anyone who's listening if this is kind of unclear, but you know, there seems to be this contradiction between doing the right thing no matter the cost and conforming your mind to reality, which I think part of that is a social reality. Or do you think it is just
here's what I think Seneca would say to this. He would say, when it comes to span of control, reality can be an awful thing. But since your character is the sine qua non and raison d'etre of who you are in this life, making good in this life, you may not be able to control other people's bad behavior, but you can certainly control your own. So you can conform to reality outside of yourself, mm-hmm. as far as control is concerned, but it doesn't mean that you have to withdraw your refusal to participate in things that you think do damage to your moral integrity.
Yeah. And if you're practicing this philosophy, you're also prepared to deal with the consequence of that.
Exactly. You know, I think there's a lot of unconscious Stoics out there. I think there's a lot of folks who are Stoics, whether in history or today, who don't realize they are, much like my wife, who was an instinctual libertarian but couldn't quite put a label on why she felt about authority the way she did. For instance, I would say that Thoreau is probably one of the greater historical figures in 19th century America, like Lysander Spooner, who represented Stoicism but didn't speak to it directly.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, let's just return to this concept of repression for a minute.
Sure,
and
sure.
Take it down to the personal level or even like a relationship level. I was really moved by a book I read many, many years ago that Stefan Molyneux actually wrote, called Real-Time Relationships. And I didn't agree with everything in the book, but it really challenged me and really had me, you know, rethink, you know, or start thinking. I shouldn't say force me to rethink. It invited me to start thinking about a lot of aspects of, you know, interpersonal and romantic and familial relationships that just had never even occurred to me at that point in my life at, you know, 31 years old, 32 years old. And, you know, one of the things he talks about in the book is getting things out there, you know, when you feel them with somebody that you love and somebody that you trust.
Does this include Molyneux's defood parents and blood relations, or just people that he runs into that are not blood relations?
No, this would include people that you are close to in a what he would describe as a voluntary way. So
I see. Relationships
that you've chosen to be in. And, you know, the idea that if emotions come up, if feelings come up, you're best served by getting them out in the open, you know, right away.
Sure.
And not, I think, you know, a lot of people hear the word repression and they imagine a kind of unhealthy bottling up. And, you know, I found that I had had a lot of relationships in life where things I felt needed to be said weren't said by me. And that kind of gnaws away, you know, over time.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it can lead to resentment, too, for the other person when you haven't even expressed the issue or the need that you're having. So I just wanted to, you know, tease that out a little bit better, that concept of repression, how it applies to ourselves, how it applies to our relationships, and see if you had any additional thoughts.
There is this notion of repressing emotions in Stoics where people have this perception that Stoics tend to be either extraordinarily emotionally stable or they have a recalcitrance to show emotions. That's not the case at all. I would say that what Stoics are trying to do is use an economy of force when it comes to emotion, in which you're using them in a constructive way for both yourself and those around you. For instance, earlier in this program or in another one, we talked about anger and how useless anger really is when it comes to the expression of anger against others. Now, is there a constructive uses of anger? Absolutely, in my mind, because I do think that anger informed part of the reason why Wilberforce did what he did, because he saw what was happening to slaves in the New World and the Old, and he objected to that. I think that anger may have informed and as a matter of fact, laid the foundation for why he did what he did. But that doesn't mean that he would stand up in front of the parliament and in an angry fashion be angry with people who disagreed with him. Because ask yourself this, if you're angry at somebody who disagrees with you, what have you done for yourself and what have you done for that person that you disagree with?
Right.
Most likely for yourself, you've done nothing. Most likely for the person you disagree with, you've alienated them, in which no rational conversation or discourse whatsoever will yield any results.
Right. Yeah. See, there's a lot of these powerful negative passions like anger or jealousy or I don't know, maybe even regret that can be blurted out, I guess, in the moment, or they can be converted and harnessed and used for some better end. Right. Like if that passion is there, it can be made useful.
So maybe it would make people feel better if they knew that for the most part, the Stoic practice is not the absence of emotions or the repression of emotions, but the morphing of those emotions to something that's more constructive. For instance, what I discover with nuclear families is that fathers, when they have sons, are best able, unlike mothers, to teach sons to constructively channel naturally aggressive energies that they have.
Okay, yeah.
And I think to a certain extent, that's what's happening here, is that the Stoics say, wait, it's not bad to be angry, but it isn't very effective. It isn't very efficient. And are there more constructive channels for both yourself and, as a result, concomitantly, people around you that would lead to more constructive ends?
Yeah. The first thing that I think I was ever told, or that I remember being told about Stoicism recently, I mean, I had learned about it when I first started studying, you know, ancient Greece a little bit, you know, really as a contrast to Epicureanism. But when I started revisiting it recently, it came up on a show, I don't know, sometime within the last year. And whoever was on the show with me mentioned it's, you know, it's storing, not storing up, but reserving emotion and then using it when you need it.
Yes.
And I said, well, that sounds nice, you know, but what I've realized in the last three shows is that there are strategies for making that happen. At first, it sounded just like I said, like a nice thing to say. But after, you know, the 3+ hours we spent on Stoicism, I really understand how that is possible now.
I think so, too.
And I think when I look back, I think I understood it on a subconscious level.
You know, let's repeat this. You don't have to be a Jet Propulsion Laboratory graduate to grok this. This is not rocket science in the least. As a matter of fact, this is so nicely confluent with my own life and with home education and with libertarianism and such. It's just it's a natural fit to adopt a Stoic lifestyle.
I agree, and I just want to let the folks who are interested in this pursuit know that we have more work to do in this series.
Again, Brett, this is such a great forum. I so enjoyed this conversation. I know you look to me and you say, well, I know more about Stoicism, you know, I do than you do. That may be the case a little bit, but I can't tell you how much I learn whenever I have these conversations myself that helps me to, I guess, either clarify or sharpen my Stoic skill set.
I have to say, doing this show over the last few years has been the best education that I've had, for sure.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yeah.
For instance, when I was in school, I was a political economy major, and I discovered more on C-SPAN than I did in the classroom.
But part of that is mixing your own thought and curiosity with what you're seeing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The classroom doesn't seem to invite it as much as the outside world does, right? Especially not in college.
But most classrooms do not invite Stoic pedagogy.
Absolutely. Right.
They hate it.